Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air, tells the story of the enigmatic group of men and women who first risked their lives to take to the air and so discovered a new dimension of human experience. Why they did it, what their contemporaries thought of them, and how their flights revealed the secrets of our planet in wholly unexpected ways is its unique subject. Again, the title of the book is Falling Upwards. It's a pleasure to welcome Richard Holmes to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
It's great.
What brought you to this idea to explore this subject of how we took to the air?
Well, I think it was a combination of many things. A previous book I'd written called The Age of Wonder, which is about scientists in the Romantic period, that's the beginning of the 19th century. And there was a story about balloonists in that book, and I thought, this is a fascinating subject. It's worth really going into. Also, it reminded me, which the book opens with a little story, when I was a 4-year-old kid, I had an uncle who I rather admired, a Royal Air Force pilot, and he took me to a fair. I remember I was only 4, and he bought one of those, you know, helium red party balloons, you know, the kind of thing that float up to the ceiling. Anyway,
sure.
He tied it to the top button of my shirt and looked down at me and said, "Richard, maybe you're going to fly." And I thought I really would fall upwards into the sky. I was age 4. And that was the beginning of a kind of fascination with balloons. And once I got onto the subject, the stories attached to the balloonists are quite amazing. Not only men, but women, how they flew over the Civil War battlefields, for example, or how they escaped from the siege of Paris, for example, or how they flew up to find out how high you could go before you died, basically, which is the answer is about 7 miles. And then a lot of those people were rather scientific, but some of them were kind of great showmen and showwomen who did amazing acts from balloons. So it allowed me to kind of what I think of as overfly the 19th century and draw some parallels with modern, not only hot air ballooning, but satellites and looking at the Earth from above. So that was the kind of the beginnings of the book.
What do you think the initial motive for most was to take to the air? What were they hoping to get out of the experience? Because, I mean, you write about all of the things that came from it, of course, and in seeing the planet in a whole new way, and of course, meteorological questions that were answered, and cartography and meteorology and so much more. But what was it, do you think, that first got them interested in the idea?
Yeah, I mean, it is extraordinary because it's been around in kind of like myth. Everybody knows the story of Icarus, you know, the guy who flew too close to the sun and his wings melted and so on. There are a lot of stories like that about flying, but no one's able to do it. But it's sort of, you've only got to, the poet Victor Hugo said, if you look up in the sky, you see two things. You see birds and you see clouds. And the question is, which could we be? Could we be a bird or could we be a cloud? And the answer in 1780 was a cloud. And in fact, this all began with two brothers. The names are familiar, I think, Montgolfier. And actually, they weren't scientists at all. They were ordinary paper manufacturers. They made paper bags, basically. And one day, they held a paper bag over a fire, and it filled with hot air, and it took off. And they suddenly thought, wait a minute, we've got something here. And they built very big paper bags, and then they took them to Paris. And then in September 1783, the first two men flew beneath one of these, a 90-foot, by then silk-made, decorated balloon. And I think there was a feeling that, first of all, that the idea, this is a new kind of adventure. And I think people are always ready to try that. But much more is, I think, they reckoned they were onto a completely revolutionary form of transport. Remember, we're still in the age of, you know, horse and cart and ships and so on. And when these balloons started flying, first of all, hot air and then hydrogen, the true hydrogen balloon, all in 1783, they reckoned that this would be a social revolution because people would be able to move across all boundaries, across the seas and so on. And the first part of the book is the both tragic and comic story of how they discovered that there are a lot of things that balloons are good for, but leaving A and getting to B is not one of them. They're very good at leaving A, but you can't steer them and you don't know where you're going to go. So that gradually turned into an investigation, not flying horizontally, but going vertically. How high can we go, and what do we see? How does the Earth look from up there? So the urge to do that moved from the idea of a revolutionary transport to an instrument of discovery, and in some ways of kind of meditation on the planet. So you get quite philosophical types doing it, but also kind of real showman types doing it, and pure scientists doing it. And it really, in the early 19th century, people called it the Balomania. I mean, the fascination with it. It affected, for example, the way people dressed. There were balloon dress styles and balloon furniture, balloon lamps, balloon fans. Amazing thing. And then gradually it changed into this more scientific approach to see how high we could go and see what you could see from there. So that's part of the story.
You, of course, were just talking about impact. One of my favorite sections of the book is how much it impacted literature and writers.
Yes, you're right. Because one of the extraordinary things, I say that wherever there's a balloon, there's a basket beneath it. And in the basket is a story. This seems to be true of any balloon launch you can think of or you take part in. Same for me. And one of the things I discovered that almost immediately, writers got interested in it and began to fantasize and write imaginative trips. There was a German writer, Baron Munchausen, who immediately began inventing stories about enormous balloons that could pick up entire buildings and move them during the night. A kind of trick-or-treat event, all right? Your building, you wake up and it's been moved by balloons somewhere else. Mary Shelley, the author, you know, of Frankenstein, the novel that she next wrote, which is called The Last Man, has a balloon flying sequence in it, someone flying from London to Scotland. And this continues. One of the things that really really tickled me was that there's a very brilliant scientific description of a flight made in 1836 across from London, across the Channel, and into Eastern Europe at night. And there's a wonderful account of flying that, and actually how frightening it is at night, because the night seems to close in around you. And aboard that basket, it was an English pilot called Charles Green, but he brought with him an Irish writer called Monk Mason, who wrote a wonderful account of this. And he said it was, in the depth of the night, it was like flying, our balloon was flying into a block of black marble. Wonderful image, being entombed in the night. And I discovered that this description, which he published in a little book, was then read over here by none other than Edgar Allan Poe, who kind of used that idea of being closed into a black marble tomb, which affects his stories. But also, he began to write, some of his earliest stories are about balloon flights. For example, they're about a very serious story about a man who flies in a balloon to the moon, very well described.
Mm.
And another story about the first people who flew from Ireland across the Atlantic to America. And Poe sold this particular as a news story to the New York Sun, which ran the story about the pilots who'd flown in their balloon across the Atlantic with their log, their journals, and so on, all quoted from, all described by Poe. And this increased the circulation of the New York Sun newspaper by 3 times. And it was only on the 3rd day that Edgar Allan Poe revealed, of course, it was a complete fiction. It was a hoax. He'd made it up. And this goes on right through the history of writing. Jules Verne is another author who writes a kind of science fiction writing based on balloons. His first science fiction was a book called 5 Weeks in a Balloon. It was about how 3 English, mad Englishmen, ballooned right across Africa. Wonderful detailed account of that, scientifically correct. Wonderful descriptions of flying over a volcano, being attacked by condors in the sky, being attacked by tribesmen who think they've come from the moon, all with these 3 cool Englishmen in it. It was reviewed as this wonderful documentary book. And, of course, it was a complete fiction again. It's just a novel.
Mm.
So I follow that through. That goes on right through the story, and it involves people like Charles Dickens, for example, interested by balloons, or H.G. Wells. So that's a thread that runs through the book, the factual flights, and then the imaginative effect it has on people.
And even for the imagination of children, and you include Babar the elephant in the book, which sort of harkens back to your childhood and having that balloon attached to your jacket.
Yeah. Well, yes, that's right. There's a lovely picture, isn't there, of Babar, King Babar, on his honeymoon with his Princess Celeste, and they're in a balloon, which is actually related to some of the Jules Verne stories. And I should say that balloons seem to have, I've done quite a lot of modern ballooning in order to research this book, and it does have an amazing effect on children. When I was just flying 24 hours ago in upstate New York, and rather cold, brisk morning, and as we were coming down, always the dogs bark. The dogs know about a hot air balloon before anybody else on the land. And then, always when you come into land, within minutes of landing, from nowhere, children are alive. I can't tell you why, but they just seem to appear. And on this occasion, can you imagine, this is in the quite deep countryside in upstate New York. And as we began to come down, and you can fly very, very low, you can actually brush the tops of the trees. The leaves actually brush the basket. You have that control over it. We suddenly saw that on the little lanes, where, you know, the bright yellow school buses, we were coming to collect the kids. And then, of course, the kids in little groups, you know, waiting at the gates of farms and so on. And they were all, saw the balloon, all waving. And there was you could tell there was a kind of revolution on the ground, because they didn't want to get in the school bus. They wanted to wait for the balloon to come down. And that's very characteristic of balloons. And as I talk in front of me, I have a drawing by a seven-year-old. Somehow she heard me talking on the radio or something, got sent through the hot air balloon for Richard from Amelia, age seven. It's a wonderful chalk picture of this obviously crazy Professor Richard Holmes climbing into a very beautifully crayon-drawn balloon, hot air balloon. So there's a kind of joyousness about ballooning, which I also try to capture in the book, and certainly in the pictures, of which I think there are 150 pictures. I think,
beautiful pictures included in the book. I was struck by, in reading the book, I was recently at the Air and Space Museum, the Smithsonian in Washington, and one of the things that struck me in reading the book is that when you think of flight and Orville and Wilbur Wright and that plane and that first plane of just over 100 years ago, and then the amazing advances that were made so quickly within 10, 20, 30 years. And when you think of the balloon, the mechanics of it really haven't changed that much since the very early days.
Yes, it's absolutely true. And almost the very first one, which was launched in Paris just after the first Montgolfier, by a member of the French Scientific Academy, Dr. Alexandre Charles, rather a hero of mine. His balloon was very like a modern hydrogen, not hot air, but a hydrogen balloon, which used all the same principles, you know, the balloon in a net inside it, and then with ballast sacks, which you adjust the height by throwing out, with various cords to adjust the balloon, and a basket made of wicker, which they still are. The balloons you fly in today are made of wicker. It's true that the mechanics of it, and I think in a way that's part of the fascination, the charm, that the, as it were, the engineering, the technology side of it hasn't been improved, but the way balloons have been used and what we've seen from them, a kind of example I would give was the first people in America to fly over the Niagara Falls. Wonderful descriptions of that. And then them realizing the geological fact that you could see that the way the river, the falls, were gradually working their way back up in geological time, up through the rock. And you could see this from a balloon very, very clearly because of the patterns of the rock and so on. So very surprising things were continually happening, even though the technology wasn't that much improved. And I think that paradox leads you to ask bigger questions about where do scientific advances take us. I'd also say that it's not quite clear. The technology of the balloon may have stayed the same, but, for example, in the 1860s, the very first aerial photography was taken. The first, very difficult to do in those days. They used a kind of collodion emulsion way of fixing the prints, and it was very difficult to do in the basket because of the hydrogen gas affected the chemistry of that. But in 1858, the first photographs, we reckon that's the date, taken by Félix Nadar above Paris, and suddenly you see the city and its layout in an entirely new way. And from that, even better quality very quickly from above Boston. Beautiful shots taken in 1860 of the harbor and the city of Boston. And I argue in the book and show it that there's a direct link from that to then the beginning of satellite imagery, which is just, again, taken with better cameras from higher up, and how dependent we now are on satellites, not only for weather prediction, but for knowing our knowledge of crops and agriculture, the whole state of the planet, global warming, everything like that is information provided in a form that originally the balloon pioneered. So I make those long links.
The story is such an enthralling one. The name of the book is Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air. It is published by Pantheon. Richard Holmes, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
It was nice to fly with you.
A delight. Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Again, the title of the book is Falling Upwards. It's published by Pantheon. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.